welcome to All in the Mind. Natasha Mitchell with you. Thanks for your company. Today, the psychology of a good yarn. From fairy tales and ancient epic legends to Hollywood blockbusters, human society would almost be unthinkable without stories. But is the tradition of telling stories more than simply social entertainment? Does it appeal to a deeper need in our psyche? And are we at risk of losing this in our contemporary world of mass marketing and homogenisation? Have stories like sneakers become branded? Earlier this year, we explored the genre of the nuclear movie as a vehicle for expressing our collective fears. And today we're picking up on that idea once again, that storytelling has immense psychological power. Peter Lavelle is your guide.
Once upon a time, there lived a man and his wife who were very unhappy because they had no children. These good people had a little window at the back of their house, which looked onto the most lovely garden, full of all manner of beautiful flowers and vegetables.
When King Uther Pendragon heard news that his queen had given birth to a healthy son, his thoughts leapt forward to a mighty kingdom under the red banner of the Pendragon. But great was his rage when he learned that Merlin, his advisor and sage, had claimed the babe as payment for his service and fled with the child into the night. And though the king searched...
Look back in time, most early stories, particularly mythologies, really derive their sense from nature. They must have been an attempt by early humans to make sense of the things that were happening around them in their outer world. I think it's hard to imagine that the part of human nature isn't to actually seek some sort of sense and order, some sense of constancy in our world, which otherwise becomes unworkable if it's totally unpredictable and unknowable. And stories are a way in which I think we render some sense into our being.
What's the point of a story? What's the purpose of a good yarn? Historians and anthropologists argue that they've been a way that pre-industrial societies attempt to make sense of the world around them. Why the sun travels around the earth, why crops grow in spring and not in winter, or how the earth was created. They're a way of inducting young men and women into adulthood and teaching them the laws of the tribe. But for psychotherapists, they can mean something much more. They can give us insights into the human psyche. It was in the 1900s that Sigmund Freud and his then-student Carl Jung coined the term the unconscious. This, they argued, was a part of our mind below the surface of our conscious mind that was the dumping ground for impulses and desires that consciousness deemed unsuitable for polite society. Forbidden sexual feelings, destructive or violent impulses, bodily instincts and drives were hidden there, or repressed, as Freud called it. Carl Jung later split the unconscious into two parts, an individual unconscious, rather like Freud's, and something he called the collective unconscious, which contained universal symbols he called archetypes. Dr. Peter O'Connor is a Melbourne-based psychologist and author of Beyond the Mist, a book on Celtic mythology. He runs group therapy sessions for men using dreams and storytelling.
In essence, it is that we don't come into life tabula rasa, a blank sheet. We come in with a history, just as we come in with a history of our physical being, we come into it with a history of our psychological being. And the collective unconscious refers to our experience as a race, not as a particular individual, whereas the personal unconscious refers to our individual history. And the collective unconscious then represents various, I suppose the simplest way to explain it might be various dispositions to react in certain ways to repetitive situations that humans have dealt with over time. For example, loss, death, birth, these sort of experiences that we have built up particular ways of behaving. And so what Jung particularly was able to articulate, I think, was that at times of major transitions like that, the psyche tends to dip back into history, into the collective history, to find ways of dealing with them, and hence we produce archetypal symbols. Now, one of the, I think, wonderful parts of mythology is that it does actually help us to understand these archetypal symbols in the collective unconscious. For example, so much mythology is to do with the eternal cycle of birth, life and death, so that at times of loss, for example, mythologies that are to do with birth, life and death enable us to begin to comprehend that following any loss is also a birth. I suppose a precise example would be the Greek story of Demeter and Persephone, where Demeter loses her daughter abducted by Hades into the underworld, and then finally she does retrieve her, and that the story helps us to see that Persephone represents 6 months in the underworld as winter and 6 months above the surface as spring and summer. A way of sort of picturing, if you like, in an imaginative language, the process that all of life is forever changing and renewing itself, but loss and death are part of that. And that's an example, I think, of how we can use mythology to help us to comprehend what we're feeling, particularly at major points of transition.
Psychotherapist Peter O'Connor. Like many of Carl Jung's ideas, his notion of a collective unconscious is controversial. But for others, it explains why so many of our stories, myths and fables are universal. The great American anthropologist Joseph Campbell argued that across all cultures, myths and legends have dealt with the same universal themes and challenges, regardless of whether they were told by a Navajo Indian, a troubadour in the court of a Celtic king, or by Aboriginal elders. Jung's work greatly influenced Campbell, who today is best known for his major work, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, first published in 1947. In it, he distilled all the world's mythologies into a sort of grand unifying theory. This was the journey of the hero. To him, stories were a metaphorical way of expressing how we all face what are challenges in our everyday lives. Here's Joseph Campbell in a television interview recorded shortly before his death in 1987.
There is a certain typical hero sequence of actions which can be detected in stories from all over the world and from many, many periods of history. This can be seen also in the simple initiation ritual, where a child has to give up his childhood and become an adult, has to die, you might say, to its infantile personality and psyche, and come back as a self-responsible adult. It's a fundamental experience that everyone has to undergo. We're in our childhood for at least 14 years, and then to get out of that posture of dependency, psychological dependency, into one of psychological self-responsibility requires a death and resurrection. And that is the basic motif of the hero journey. Leaving one condition, finding the source of life to bring you forth in a richer or more mature or other condition.
I think they describe what the psychologists call life stage transition moments, and these happen to everyone a number of times.
Dr. Jonathan Young is a psychologist, writer, and lecturer based in Santa Barbara at the Center for Story and Symbol. He collaborated with Joseph Campbell in the last years of Campbell's life and was the founding curator of the Joseph Campbell Archives and Library.
When childhood is over, it's time to enter young adulthood, and the transition is wrenching. There's a time when we transit into something like elderhood. There's a later time when a person has to cross retirement or something. There are key moments in life when huge changes take place, and they tend to be terribly disorienting. Even a positive change like finishing a college program or getting married or moving to a new city, these can be things of great benefit, but they are so different that we have to change to come to terms with them. And I think the stories help us. They're little roadmaps, if you will, or guidebooks to the unfamiliar.
And herein lies the real psychological power of stories. We can think of our lives as heroes' journeys writ small. When we experience a story or a myth, we are, in a sense, experiencing our own stories. The struggles and the challenges of the hero figure are also our own struggles and challenges that can require the very same heroic courage as the great figures from mythology demonstrated. And in this sense, we follow the same pattern or journey of the hero Joseph Campbell described. Dr. Jonathan Young.
In Joseph Campbell's summary, what he called the hero's journey, he goes into great detail in each part of the process of what exactly will happen, that there is a call, which is an event, usually a very troubling event, a very disastrous or upsetting event, that pulls one out of ordinary experience and starts you in the direction of the adventure. For those in stories, sometimes war breaks out or a parent is murdered or something like that. In our lives, this is the this is losing your job or a hideous divorce or a reversal of one's fortunes or something. And it you can't be resisted. It's pretty large, pretty compelling. And so you are then tossed into something disorienting, an exotic experience. It can take you to a foreign place, but it definitely will take you into unfamiliar feelings and experiences and situations that you will have to cope with. That's called the threshold passage, where one crosses away from the familiar into the strange. And it's usually very distressing, but you don't have to take it all on alone. You get some help. These are called companions or allies in the journey, and some guidance. There are mentoring characters in these stories. Beyond the mentor, there's the tests and trials and temptations, the difficulties that come in the story. There's the dark night of the soul where you lose hope and perhaps have a whole period of despair. What's really happening there is that your old way of looking at things is kind of falling apart. So it's a very difficult part of the journey. And then the supreme ordeal is essentially coming to terms with your own death, the limits of your ability to control things. So it's a chaotic, terrifying part of the bottom of the arc. And then the return journey, where the seeker or hero begins finding their way back to a regular life. And the way back is quite challenging in its own right. But you do get something for your trouble. Joseph Campbell called it the boon, the reward. Sometimes it's called the elixir because it has healing power. But this is the insight or the wisdom or the talent or the gift that you hold on the way back and have a thing of great value in yourself. And it's also of value to others. So there's a position of service that tends to come toward the end of the whole thing because you're trying to share some of what you've learned.
Myths achieve much of their power through the rituals and ceremonial settings associated with them. And throughout history, myths have been told in special places and at special times, like sacred festivals in sacred groves, caves, or grounds, and with guidance from experienced elders as the storytellers. Experiencing the ritual was often as important as the story itself.
There is a profound connection between ritual and myth. In the ancient times, any mythic story would have a ritual that went with it, and a ritual would always be built directly on myth. One way to enter into this mythic imagination is to participate in ritual. If you took the story of the Buddha, for example, there would be this moment when he is sitting in the Bodhi tree, under the tree, and gaining enlightenment. And then if you're a practicing Buddhist, you would meditate and in some way replicate this, although not exactly copying it, but to some degree trying to enter into that moment.
And so we enter into the ritual, into the story. It's our way of recognizing and dealing with the challenges in our own lives. Therapists, especially Jungian therapists, take it a step further. They use stories in a therapeutic setting with their patients by working with their patients' dreams. Like myths and legends, dreams, they believe, are also full of universal story images.
Carl Jung believed that mythic stories, whether they were creation tales or legend or sagas or fairy tales, that these wisdom stories are very dreamlike, that they are condensed perspective from the unconscious, something very much like a dream, except that we have come up with them collectively. So the tools that Jungian-oriented psychotherapists use to study dreams can be used to ponder the guidance in these stories. Jung also believed that each person has a myth that they're living in their life, and they didn't make the myth up. There's a myth going on in each life, but we are not the authors. The myths are the authors. They are making up. They are creating us. If you knew what kind of mythic story you were living, you could live it well.
Dr. Jonathan Young. Psychologist Peter O'Connor agrees that like myths, dreams are also expressions of our unconscious.
There's a great similarity, Peter, and I think that's actually, personally, that's how I got so interested in myths, was actually through my clinical work with dreams. It was originally a British anthropologist of the 30s, Jane Harrison, then I think Joseph Campbell also rephrased this saying, which says that myths are the dreams of the people and dreams are the myth of the individual. And that's the link, that they both are imaginative language, but dreams tend to be the daily myth that we're engaging in, which every now and then, of course, overlaps with a major myth. So one has to approach both dreams, from my perspective, fairy tales and myths, with an imaginative, metaphorical way of thinking rather than a logical way of thinking. They produce images of feelings we have. And, of course, that's the direct link to fairy tales and myths. They also speak in an imaginative language of feelings that we have. Now, mythology and fairy tales, and, of course, literature above all else, can help us to actually restore ourselves, I could use that word, or to begin to identify, ah, yes, that's what I feel.
Psychotherapist Dr. Peter O'Connor, and on ABC Radio National, you're listening to All in the Mind, coming to you also on Radio Australia and the net. And today we're looking into the psychology of storytelling. Peter Lavelle is exploring the psyche through the legends, tales and myths we've always shared with each other.
Cyborg. Cybernetic organism.
No, he was bleeding.
All right, listen. The Terminator's an infiltration unit. Part man, part machine. Fully armored, very tough. But outside, it's living human tissue. Flesh, skin, hair, blood, grown for the cyborgs.
We live in the age of the blockbuster special effects movie, the airport novel, the TV soap. These are our modern popular myths. But do these stories fulfill the same role that myths and fairy tales used to, of collectively guiding us through the journey of life? Are Tom Clancy, Seinfeld and The Terminator really expressions of the collective unconscious? Psychologist Dr. Jonathan Young.
I think we're in a golden age of storytelling, and I think that there is great wisdom even in action movies. Stories tend to reflect human experience. Stories that are very, very popular often reflect something quite profound about human experience. The fact that we have so many movies, so many more channels of opportunity to see films and dramas and more television, cable channels and all of this to choose from, I think has really led to a kind of flowering of the literary imagination.
In the 1980s, Hollywood discovered the work of Joseph Campbell, thanks to George Lucas, the creator of the Star Wars films. Lucas wrote the Star Wars scripts using Joseph Campbell's classic hero journey that you heard about earlier. In Star Wars, Luke Skywalker is the hero, and his epic journey is to defeat an evil intergalactic empire, with help from Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda, and a couple of robots. At the climax, he faces his nemesis, Darth Vader, a sort of Black Knight of the galaxy. Here's George Lucas speaking in the documentary Star Wars and the Magic of Myth.
I had always had an interest from the days when I was in college in mythology and how mythologies transfer certain values to the next generation, certain ideas about how we operate, how the society operates, what's expected of you, how you define your role in a society and what your obligations are to that society and what the standards that are set. And that's mythology. That's what it was. It was a way of one generation telling the next generation, this is how you fit. And doing it in a storytelling way as it has related to the past. And one of the prime issues of mythology was that it was always over the hill. It was always in this mysterious place where anything can happen. And I said, well, the only place we've got left is space.
Lucas has been criticized because the Star Wars films, the five of them, essentially follow the same plot line and rework that arc again and again. But that's nothing to apologize for. The hero's journey is an eternal pattern that we need to go through many times in our life's journeys. And he was drawing heavily on Campbell. Later he got to know Campbell rather well. He thought George Lucas had really understood the way the pattern worked, what it had to say, particularly the moral decision that each seeker or hero must make as to whether to serve the machine, the values of the machine, or whether to serve the values of the heart, the human values. And Lucas really presents that clearly.
George Lucas wasn't the only filmmaker in Hollywood to be influenced by Joseph Campbell's ideas. Steven Spielberg, Jim Henson, and George Miller, creator of the Mad Max movies, also used the hero myth model to tell stories on the big screen. Has Hollywood bought the rights to the collective unconscious?
Yes, it became very popular in Hollywood then to try to build stories along this model. And I think this is kind of marvelous, the way this ancient wisdom is sneaking in to the studios, which are really mainly interested in making money. But if it can serve a human emotional need, the chance that people will buy more tickets to that film tends to go up.
But how healthy is this golden age of storytelling when so many Hollywood movies portray scenes of exploitation and violence? And psychologist Dr. Peter O'Connor has another concern.
What I think is more of a worry is the sort of standardization and homogenization of myth and film, for example, that the American culture seems to be indulging in, where you're actually given stories rather than actually encouraged to develop your own stories.
By that you mean the loss of a smaller community's stories and its culture simply being swamped by the massive distribution systems of, say, the Hollywood studios or the big multinational publishers, for example.
Yes, and that most of their stories are geared within the economic rationalism to sell, not to actually speak to individuals or the soul. They don't actually speak to so many people. They don't provide enough variety and differentiation to meet the wide range of needs and feelings that we need to give form to. One of the things you can see is the tremendous success of Harry Potter. This is clearly doing what the old myths would have done, as people are enjoying the story, the magic, the imaginative life. But I do think we have nevertheless become relatively impoverished because we haven't valued, if you like, the creative lives and the creative arts as much in our modern world as perhaps was valued in the older times. And we don't tend to have time now to tell stories, and we tend to get the standard stories, you know, via the televisions, etc. One of the things once was said about myths is that they are food for the soul. And if you take the soul, you know, from its original Greek word as psyche, that myths are actually ways in which we sustain. We tend to have one predominant story at present, and that's a rather impoverished one that we would call economic rationalism, that it is a mythology, it's the contemporary mythology. But of course it's used to explain everything one can imagine, from healthcare to well-being to justify wars, on it goes. Now, when you have a monomyth like this, I think it fails to capture our experience as human beings. And the wisdom of the Greeks, of course, was that they had so many myths, and therefore their stories reflect the wide range of human experiences.
So will we continue to tell our stories at all? Peter O'Connor believes we can't exist without them.
Not to have a story is, in fact, not to be human, that one's disconnected from one's actual being. So we have to, in some ways, continue to re-mythologize ourselves. That is, we have to continue to stay in touch with our imaginative life and begin to construct, if you like, and renew the stories that we've had of who we are.
Melbourne-based psychologist Dr. Peter O'Connor and anthropologist Joseph Campbell would have agreed. Campbell believed that as a society changes, its myths must change with it. And the most compelling myth of the future, he argued, is bigger than all of us.
The only myth that's going to be worth thinking about in the immediate future is one that's talking about the planet. Not this city, not these people, but the planet and everybody on it. That's my main thought for what the future myth is going to be.
A folk hero of sorts himself, Joseph Campbell there, speaking just before his death in 1987. And your guide today through the myth and magic of storytelling was Dr. Peter Lavelle, who, by the way, also writes for the ABC's Health Matters website, which is at abc.net.au/health. And you'll also find information about the show today with transcripts and audio on our website. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and click on All in the Mind under the programs list. You'll find plenty there to tuck into, as well as our email address. We love to hear from you. Thanks today to sound engineer David Bates and producer Sue Clark. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and I look forward to your company again next week.